This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Human rights activist and Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka is our guest this afternoon. The poet and playwright's latest book, You Must Set Forth at Dawn, tells the chronicle of his life as an adult in and in exile from Nigeria. Wole Soyinka has repeatedly been exiled from his homeland. When he was 33 years old, he was imprisoned for appealing for a ceasefire during Nigeria's civil war. He spent 2 years in solitary confinement before his release in 1969. In his 1996 book, The Open Sore of a Continent, Soyinka explored the history and future of Nigeria. The book followed the execution of writer Ken Sarawiwa and eight others. In 1997, a death sentence was issued against Soyinka. Born in Nigeria in 1934, he studied at the University College of Ibadan, then at Leeds University. He is a prolific writer, the author of numerous plays, books of nonfiction and poetry, and two novels. In his 1981 memoir, Ake, The Years of Childhood, Soyinka writes of his Yoruba childhood. At the end, he is 11 and about to embark on the challenges of becoming an adult at a time when Nigeria had not yet achieved independence from Britain. When Nigeria won its independence in 1960, Soyinka returned to Nigeria, founded an acting company, and produced his play, A Dance in the Forests. His latest book, You Must Set Forth at Dawn, writes in this book, he writes about his exile and the reign of General Sani Abacha. But he also writes about being a Nigerian and his love for his countrymen. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Soyinka, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
As I mentioned, in 1997, you had been sentenced to death. You were in exile, but with the end of Abacha's reign, exiles were invited back, a prospect that you say and you must set forth at dawn, you and your fellow exiles, at first thought hilarious. What was the situation?
Okay, let me make a correction first of all. Yes, I was declared wanted, dead or alive, and I was on trial, but it was in absentia, and we never really got down to the sentencing or the conviction before Sani Abacha very kindly departed for another domain. So I wasn't actually sentenced to death, but I was under the threat of death.
You were in danger.
Well, you know, sure.
Thank you for correcting me.
No, that's okay. I mean, it's misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's there's so much in your life to try and it was a very difficult process of trying to put it all together. you've led a spectacular life.
Yes, I suppose it's been interesting. Yes. Yes, I was indeed invited back. In fact, the new Abdusalami, who took over from Abacha, was very anxious to have the exiles back in the country, and me especially made a special effort through his ambassadors to locate me and invite me back. And you're quite right. At the beginning, we found it rather hilarious because the notices, the wanted notices, dead or alive, had not yet been rescinded. The trials had not been formally annulled. And Abacha's people were still very much around, looking for an excuse to serve their master, even in the other world. So we weren't over-anxious to pick up his invitation immediately.
Hmm. When did it become something you could think about seriously?
Oh, after I met him. Abdusalami, we met in New York, I think it was New York Plaza Hotel, myself and my lieutenants, and we had a long discussion, and he assured us he'd put in place the necessary instructions to ensure that no accident happened to us through some overzealous officers. That was just a few months after we met. In other words, by December 1999, a very bad at dates, unless I refer to my diary, that is about 6 months after Abacha's death, we were ready to return.
Mm. And tell us about that homecoming. What was it like?
Also about what? Homecoming?
Yes.
Oh, that was tumultuous and really, really overwhelming, very moving. It was, for me, a surprise because as I wrote in my memoirs, I never really felt I had left home since I carried that nation very much around in my head, nonstop, you know, just continuously. So traveling back, I didn't experience any kind of anticipatory excitement, any emotions. It was like just recovering the physical terrain, whose mental contours and impositions had stayed with me throughout. But arriving physically and encountering this, this tumult of people, you know, I was very moved, yes.
Yeah. That scene at the airport was really something.
It was indeed.
At first you thought no one was there.
Yes, yes, this is one of the interesting things. They'd cleared the entire interior of the airport, the arrival section, the departure section, pushed everybody out. So it was just bare. And until I happened to look up the balcony, the sort of, which overlooks the lounge, and saw that the workers, airlines officials, so on, had been herded, even up there. I mean, it's really ridiculous, really, really ridiculous. But it gives you an idea of the kind of security sensibilities that existed at the time. I felt my safety with Abu Salam's government and the airport command felt that my safety could only be guaranteed if the whole place was cleared. It was preposterous, really.
Yeah. Now, that was 1999-2000, correct?
Yes, that's right.
So, what's the situation today? Are you spend much time in Nigeria today?
Well, the situation, I'm afraid, is not very encouraging. There are problems which existed long before the present regime. The problems of religion, religious extremism, encroachment and increasing aggressiveness of religious fundamentalists. On the one hand, then you have the restlessness in the oil-producing areas, from which you may recall the state murdered writer, Kenzo Wiwa, came. And he was killed under Sani Abacha's regime, he and his eight companions of Ogoni extraction. Then you had things like boundary disputes. So it's not that there were no problems before, and one expected that these would remain with us for some time.
Mm.
But now the whole situation has been complicated by the resolve, the obsession of the incumbent, General Olusegun Obasanjo, demobilized soldier, wanting to subvert the constitution in order to perpetuate himself in office in the manner of discredited and unlamented African heads of state seem to think that they are born to the position. And the manner of his going about it is so reminiscent of past dictators, including Sani Abacha, in certain aspects. I mean, he's nowhere. I don't want to appear to exaggerate. It's not, you know, of the Abacha mold. But at the same time, his methods and his intransigence remind one of some of Abacha's efforts to make himself like president of Nigeria.
Mm.
And so we're back to the old situation of having to resist this resolve to undermine the sovereign will of the people.
Mm. How does one resist? How does one resist? What are people doing?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, in spite of government obstacles and threats of violence and even threats of trial for treason, been launched as the heads of the civil society, the leaders of the movement, we've been pursuing what we call a sovereign national conference, which is trying to fashion out a new constitution for the nation. Because the one we have right now is a fraud. It's one which is forced down the throat of the nation by the military. And so we're first of all trying to get a constitution going, which will be acceptable to all Nigerians, a document which can use as an instrument of resistance. Two, the civil society, including political opposition groups, mounting demonstrations, embarking on educational campaigns, conducting rallies, and preparing once again to return to the barricades if necessary. It's amazing because it's so clear. If you go through the media, take straw polls among the public. The Nigerian nation is against any further attempt to tailor unilaterally the constitution. It's just not acceptable. However, Obasanjo and his cohorts of sycophants and political jobbers are determined to forge ahead. But the resistance is building up.
Hmm. What do you think the outlook is near term?
The consequences of this man succeeding are so grim, so grave, that I cannot even begin to contemplate the effort succeeding. The implications are just too unpredictable. It means, if he succeeds, that anybody who comes in can now, using this as precedent, write his own constitution. Knowing, as I do, the sheer spread of opposition to this effort, I don't think he can succeed.
Hmm. Where is the process of the proposed constitution? Where is it in terms of its moving through the system?
Ah, well, it won't attempt. You're talking about this constitution that we're working on now.
That you're working on, yes. Mm,
no, it won't attempt to go through the system. In fact, the whole idea is for it to create a new system. Unlike the phony constitutional review conference, which Obasanjo summoned in Abuja to undermine our effort, unlike that, which has been repudiated in unmistakable terms, and unlike this, Obasanjo effort, in which he just handpicked a few people, allocated membership of the constitutional party to members of his own party, to his governors, with a few token nominations in the direction of the opposition, those who guaranteed to, mostly they were those who were guaranteed to rubber stamp whatever he wanted. Unlike that effort, this effort has involved the grassroots organizations, the ethnic nationalities, civil society. And when I talk of civil society, I'm talking about NGOs, professional organizations, market women, the labor movement, lawyers' association, even the military and the police, receiving memoranda from all of them, going back, as I said, to the leaders of ethnic groups for them to actually elect their representatives to this conference, which we call PRONACO, and then the results will be taken back to the people for approval. And it'll be a document with which the people will challenge those who seek office in future, beginning from 2007. And they will say to them, look, do you accept this as the nation's new constitution? And it's on that basis they will promise support or refuse their support for the candidates. So the process is going on and on to the next election. And so those who are elected, those who go into the Senate and the House of Representatives, will find themselves hard put to it not to approve the new constitution.
I would imagine, though, that there are efforts to derail this process.
Oh, no question at all. Yeah. From the very beginning, we were threatened with fire and brimstone. The police issued, the most unbelievable threats, and everybody would be arrested. The whole place would be smashed up. So we just sat there and waited for them to come. But they knew they were just bluffing, trying to see if they could get away with it. Even the Constitution, even as it stands, guarantees the right of association and the rights of free expression, though this regime has done everything possible to undermine it. And in addition, the government, of course, infiltrated spoilers right into the process from the very beginning. But they were contained after doing little damage. And so the process is on right now, and it's unstoppable.
At the moment, is there fear in Nigeria? Then it sounds like there's saber rattling, but people are saying, "Well, we will carry on."
Well, it's more than saber rattling. There's been a complete abuse, misuse of the state security services, the police in particular, the police command, the SSS. Yeah, that's a secret service organization of the state, which continues to harass opposition groups. The tear gas and battening used freely against even registered political parties who just want to hold a rally to debate the provisions of Obasanjo's fake constitution. I mean, the strong arm stuff, when I said at the beginning that certain aspects of Obasanjo's regime are reminiscent of Abacha, this is what I'm talking about. There have been mysterious killings. There have been takeover of state governments by thugs. One attempted takeover, which did not succeed, that was in Anambra State in the east. One which did succeed, and that was in Oyo State in the west, near where I come from, in which thugs actually, without any resistance from the police, I would say, took over the legislative houses. I want you to imagine thugs taking over the state of California, for instance. Suddenly one day, the legislature is invaded by thugs, and the police sit on their haunches while the House of Assembly is ransacked, and people are beaten up, and the governor has to flee for his dear life. And can you imagine that happening under a so-called democracy? So, now some of these cases are in court, as I said. But this has been the pattern of what this government has been doing.
Human rights activist and Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. The poet and playwright's latest book is You Must Set Forth at Dawn. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You said in the introduction to this program that Nigeria received its independence from England in 1960. So I wanted to ask Mr. Soyinka, to what extent, that was 46 years ago, and I'm wondering to what extent many of the political problems you were just discussing and other African countries, post-colonial African countries, have similar problems. I'm wondering if how much of this is the result of the colonial experience, meaning there hasn't been enough time passed since the end of colonialism for the modern African states to adjust and find their own way in the world, so to speak, because of problems with economics and politics, and it just seems to be a very confusing situation. But I'd also like to know what you think would be a projected date when some of these problems could be settled? Another 50 years, another 100 years, or what do you think?
Good question. And there is, we have a saying in Yoruba language, not a very elegant saying, I'm afraid, but one which evolved from the experience of most African colonial state from the quote-unquote departure of the colonial powers. In other words, the methodology of departure. And the expression goes, Onyibushu Saga. Literally, that means that before departing, the white man defecated on the throne. And the consequences of that defecation, I'm afraid, are still with many African states. Nigeria is a prime example. The British government, and this is not just Wole Soyinka saying this, it's coming out in the declassified documents of some of the colonial officers in Nigeria. So the British government actually manipulated the elections, not only the elections, the first, you know, the immediate pre-independence elections of Nigeria, in favor of the most reactionary section of the nation. Not only that, they even falsified the census. Again, these are documented facts, in order to ensure that power was handed over to the section which the British government thought would be most malleable to post-independence control. And left with such sections, and Nigeria is not alone in this, a feeling of a permanent entitlement of power, which has created enormous tensions within the nation. And not only that, in terms of economic dependency through its multinational corporations, et cetera, and of course in collaboration with Western powers, it ensured that kind of economic dependency, despite the resources in the nation, was established before departing. Now, it's using this and coupled with the policy of divide and rule, in which sectional interests were encouraged to override the overall national interest, the British and other colonial powers, France, Portugal, Belgium, were made to continue, in many ways, the tensions were made to serve the interests of the departing powers. And so some of that element, I mean, a lot of that can be held responsible for the continuing instability of ex-colonial territories on the African continent. However, having said that, there comes a point at which leadership must take control. Just look at the past and say, okay, these are the problems we inherited. Now let us ally with the people themselves and determine what is the best path towards the complete recovery of our nations as truly independent entities. So we've had also a failure of leadership. We had the brutality of dictatorships, dictators who were more interested in power and the control, selfish control of resources, who found themselves, considered themselves as merely stepping into the boots of the departing colonial powers rather than forming a genuine common cause with the people. And so this rush of dictators against these dictators who were encouraged by the departing colonial offices. The Idi Amins, the Mobutu Sese Sekos, the Makayas and Nguemas, Emperor Bokassa and company, who profited from the love of the departing powers for the quote-unquote strong man, who in fact, paradoxically, were the weak men of Africa because they were actually enslaved to foreign interests. So it's a concatenation of so many factors. Now, regarding your question, how soon will all these contradictions be resolved? I'm afraid I cannot attempt to be a prophet. All I can do is try and accelerate the process in my own immediate constituency.
Mm. What is involved in the act of reconciliation?
You moved now to places like from South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're thinking also of Darfur. thinking of Sierra Leone, Liberia, where we had the most unbelievable inhuman atrocities committed, the use of child soldiers whose youth have been permanently destroyed, well, almost permanently, the breakup of family institutions, the bondage, the former pre-colonial arbitration methods and so on thrown into disarray as a result of the sudden proliferation of guns and lack of proper socio-political orientation and so on and so forth. Yes. Each society, each nation which has been involved in these hideous clashes, of course, must tailor its own strategy towards the environment, the circumstances, as well as its traditions. For instance, I can point to what happened in Sierra Leone, where traditional methods of the reintegration of child soldiers who had committed adult atrocities, that process went back to the traditions of African society, utilizing rituals of, if you like, a kind of societal exorcism to, shall we say, chase away, turn into a kind of nightmare the experience of the internal psychic disjunctures of these youths. In South Africa, you had a more comprehensive approach in which Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established. And over such a long period, you had the most harrowing testimonies. However, that process brought about a kind of purgation and a measure of reconciliation. To be able to know what happened to your vanished children, relations, comrades, it's one step towards even acknowledging that the enemy had a face and therefore could be brought into the general benefice of a collective communal humanism, humanity. In Darfur, I'm not saying that all these methods are perfect, they didn't have their flaws. I think even those who participated in them acknowledge that there are problems still. Mm-hmm. In Darfur, where the criminals are still acting with impunity, able to defy the United Nations, refusing even the officials entry into the beleaguered areas, where the Janjaweed, instrument of the Sudanese government, the Janjaweed committed to Arabization of African territory, where they're still roaming with impunity, attacking even refugee camps, and carrying their incursion into neighboring Chad, destabilizing that whole region, threatening, in fact, a complete disintegration of much of that region. We have a situation where, an ongoing situation, after Rwanda, incidentally, I omitted that scene of horror. After that, we have a situation where it's as if these other systems of social anomy and the ensuing efforts at reconciliation never did take place. You have criminals who are still riding high, protected by their regime, in spite of the fact that sealed indictments have been made against them by the International Courts of Justice. These people have names, they have faces, identities, and they're right there, and still acting. I was supposed to be part of a commission, a Nobel Laureate Commission, to visit Darfur on April 3rd, between April 3rd and April 7th. The Sudanese government at the last moment also chickened out and decided not to issue visas on some excuse or the other. Mm. So we have a cordon insanitaire, you know, something has been sealed off, criminality is being conducted even as we speak today. How do you begin to even think of a process of reconciliation in the circumstances where it's an ongoing crime? So I'm citing all these examples to let people understand that what applies in Southern Africa is not exactly what will apply in Darfur any more than it's what applied in Rwanda, any more than what applied in Sierra Leone, Liberia, etc., etc. What is lacking is what I call the preventive will. The preventive will by the international community, by the African community, by the Arab community, for instance, in the case of Darfur, Sudan, which is an Arab nation, and which is committing these crimes in the name of Arabism. Units, organizations, regional groupings, which refuse to accept their responsibility, and therefore put in question the whole ethos of reconciliation. You cannot have reconciliation when impunity still reigns, as is going on in Darfur at this very moment.
What can be done to get away from this paralysis, this lack of preventive will?
First, I think we've got to get away from what I call the language, the crippling, enervating language of political correctness. This structure of discourse called political correctness has been responsible for the dehumanization, the eradication of groups, especially in the third world, the failure, the refusal to call things by their real name. People know what the definition of genocide is. They know what rape is, mass rape. And yet, they hesitate to name these things, like the Africa Union, for instance, which is the United Nations, or said until it was too late. Say, oh, this is a family affair. It's an African problem. We'll treat it the African way. What is the African way? What is the African way of rape, for God's sake? And if there's no African way of rape, then you cannot talk about a sectional way of preventing or punishing rape. And this is, rape is being used as an instrument of ethnic cleansing in the Darfur. So there's got to be more frank speaking, especially within families and among families. The United Nations must be able to say very plainly, what is going on? Number one, it's not acceptable. And number two, the criminals will be punished. And then call on the immediately responsible nations, and then the larger community of nations to which that criminalized nation belongs, whether it's the Africa Union or the Arab League, and call on them to say, take action immediately or call for help. And we must respond. So it's a multi-pronged strategy, one of both prevention and the expression of the will to punish, not merely the individuals, but collectively, to issue sanctions against government and to be seen to issue and to enforce those sanctions, not merely threaten them.
This lack of frank speech, it serves then, I'm hearing you say, as a way to veil, maybe this is too strong a word, maybe not, cowardice.
What's the word you used last?
Cowardice. A lack of...
A lot of candor. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's something which... quite frankly, I don't understand. And I think it's a failure to empathize, to treat the victims, to empathize with the victims as human beings, not just as statistics, to actually be able to recognize the faces of victims of inhuman violations and to take their side for a change instead of issuing palliatives which fail to actually describe, to categorize those who violate them. It's pandering to power, whether power on a large scale or micro scale. It's a tendency of those who feel slightly, insecure to pander to power.
Does fear play a role here?
Sorry, this phone is a little bit. Can you say that again?
Fear. Fear.
Mm.
Fear. Are we afraid? Are we afraid not to pander? Are we afraid to speak frankly?
There's an element of that, yes. Mm. There's no question at all. It's an element of fear.
Mm. I want to go back now. We haven't really talked very much about your latest book, You Must Set Forth at Dawn, but in this book, near the end, you write about movement. And I really would like to explore this a little bit with you before we're out of time. And you say movement is the palpable sense of freedom. And this is something you've given a great deal of thought to. What toll does it take then when you are restricted in your movements? And does this have an effect on one's, not only one's physical movement, but one's thinking?
Yes, you're quite right. Movement has got to be thought of, grasped as more than the mere physical movement. The freedom of movement includes, of course, the freedom of a choice not to move. And so we're talking about volition in very comprehensive terms, and the freedom to exercise, if you like, your brain cells, your imagination, to roam wherever it will. This also has to do with the freedom of movement. If you restrict a person's access, for instance, to reading material, in other words, to knowledge, to alternative views of life, of choices, of ideology, for instance, of religion, of social strategies, as happens in many doctrinaire nations, whether of the theocratic doctrinology or the secular one, it's a level of restriction of movement which can even be far more deleterious for human development than the actual physical restriction. The physical restriction is obviously the most manifest. You shackle somebody, you put chains on somebody's leg, and put a huge ball at the end of the chain. Yes, that is the most overt form of restriction. But we also know that people in that condition have managed to find a freedom of movement of the mind, which more than compensates, can even, in a way, obliterate the physical restriction. So when I speak of movement, of course, that sense of deprivation coalesces around the physical manifestation. But the worst part of that freedom of movement is the restriction of the movement of the mind in multiple directions. If you are in solitary confinement, as I was for nearly 2 years, of course you feel that freedom, that loss of freedom most acutely. And so you have to devise ways of freeing your mind from that constrictive environment in order to survive. The mind needs to be able to travel, to roam, around ideas, concepts, experiences of others, phenomena, historic phenomena, etc., etc. The most convenient vehicle of which, of course, is books.
Mm.
And lacking that, there's a claustrophobia which you simply must overcome by some rather drastic mental exercises, which is what I had to resort to when I was in prison.
That's at the individual level. What happens when the movement of ideas is restricted at the collective level?
That's what gives rise to fundamentalism. Fundamentalism, both of the religious kind and of the secular kind. The the mind sort of treads the same spores round and round, over and over again, until it believes that the entire world is encapsulated in that very narrow spore. Now, that's dangerous enough for the individual.
Mm.
When it's a collectivity, and then, of course, that collectivity can be manipulated in any direction by just one single individual. Because then it's just a mindless mass. And I'm afraid that is the reality of much of the fundamentalism that we experience in the world today. They're not one that, I must continue to emphasize, not one that is restricted to religion, no. Nazism, you know, Nazism, nationalism was a kind of fundamentalism also. The extreme, what's now known as the vulgar Marxist school was, you know, which saw the entire universe, the entire human phenomenon through the prism of narrow Marxist schematism was also another kind of fundamentalism. The worst that we're experiencing today is, of course, you know, very blatantly, that of religious fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm. But those shackles feel so comfortable to so many.
They need. Some people need those shackles. It circumscribes their zone of concern, of inquiry. Everything is simple, straightforward. Knowledge is chewed, masticated, and spewed out in a very easy, digestible broth, which just fails to see the grit within that broth. I think the human mind tends to be rather lazy most of the time. The people who find security only in dictation, they'd rather be dictated to what to wear, what to eat, what is taboo, how to relieve their minds of boredom. It's a very cozy, very comfortable existence for many people. But then what distinguishes them from the lower breed of the animal species, or indeed the plant species?
Hmm.
What's the difference?
How do we come, we have to wrap up here. How do we come to a proper response to these forms of contemporary fundamentalism then?
We've got to open up the spaces, the access to sort of people. It's not easy, don't misunderstand me. It's not easy at all. Because physical contact is a very important part of this. Many people respond more to direct preaching with all its vocal nuances, its hypnotic, mesmerizing potential than to what is written in the book, for instance, or indeed what is broadcast. And so if you have communities which are dominated by very strong, powerful, demagogic minds, you have a process of indoctrination, brainwashing, which is very difficult to counter from outside. But we know from historic experience that breaches do occur, that their minds, even within those collectivities, which are already asking questions, which are already open to penetration. And so we cannot give up, even from outside. Those who are outside those communities, those slave communities, cannot give up, because somewhere along the way there is always a breach. And an excess is committed, and it makes people, even within those closures, ask questions. The moment the first question is asked, then answers are sought, and communication begins from within those hermetic closures. And with sufficient pressure from outside, results come eventually. Eventually, I said, it's not a rapid process.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Mr. Shoyinka, thank you so much for joining me.